You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, March 31st, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine, Rick Hassan, author of Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. Meanwhile, shelter-in-place restrictions seem to be working, and the CDC now contemplates masks for everybody. Phase 4 stimulus fight begins as the Fed estimates a potential 32% unemployment rate. Federal judge still insisting on holding dozens of immigrant families in Pennsylvania and Texas, of course, despite COVID-19 threat to them. The DOJ delivers the full Mueller report to a federal judge to review those redactions. Hungary takes another step towards dictatorship. And amidst a pandemic, the Idaho governor signs two bills discriminating against transgender folks. Meanwhile, labor actions, Whole Food employees stage a national sick out. GE workers protest to demand that they start producing ventilators. Amazon fires a strike organizing employee. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the show. It is another edition of us doing this show remotely. Thank you for joining us for it, ladies and gentlemen. We will endeavor to persevere. I hope everyone is doing okay. I imagine many of you are losing your minds. I think to a certain extent I am. I read a piece, and Naomi Klein had tweeted it out just because it was so ridiculous. It was one in the Wall Street Journal talking about how there's so many folks out there who are learning the value of homeschooling now. And I can tell you, I am not one of those people. I think after this thing is over, one of the things that I'm learning is that, A, we should be doubling the salaries of our teachers. We should be adding at least 75% to our delivery people's pay. I mean, that's what I've learned from this. This whole homeschooling, guess what? If the parents are working, very difficult to pull off. And if they're not, very difficult to pull off. But aside from that, I need a place where I can ship bourbon into the home. So that's what I need. But aside from that, let's go on to our plugs and notices, shall we? Now, Matt, are you ready with some? Okay, great. Barbara, born blue, writes us and says, "I was confused about how to answer the census for my daughter, who is normally in college in another state, but living at home with this quarter due to COVID-19. The Census Bureau put out this helpful video to explain how students should be counted, and specifically addresses the current situation. We will put that link in. It's a YouTube." It's a YouTube link, so check it out. It'll be in our plugs and notices 331, COVID-19 plugs and notices 331, youtube.com/Sam Cedar. I'm an organizer in Hudson County, New Jersey for the Mutual Aid Tenant Collective of Hudson County, or MATCH. We focus on doing mutual aid work in Hudson County as well as tenant organizing. We are looking for in Hudson County. Okay, we are currently fundraising right now to help families struggling due to COVID-19 in Hudson County to get needed groceries and supplies, as well as making sure that we contact with residents that may be facing an illegal eviction during the pandemic. Details with donation links to our PayPal and Venmo can be found at the NJMATCH, M-A-T-C-H, Twitter handle. NJMATCH Twitter. You can search on there. We have a direct link to it as well. That's from Colin. Becca says, I was wondering how to support my local bookstore, Auntie's Bookstore in Spokane, Washington. If you like audiobooks, you can support them through Libro.fm, Libro.fm. This is for Matt. And many independent bookstores may use Libro.fm as their audiobook service. Better than giving money to Bezos. So Bezos. Matt, that's for you. Some colleagues and I are working on getting our new telemedicine practice up and running, hopefully within a week or two. Most states are currently allowing telehealth across state lines without license in that state. Some require temporary license, but I anticipate we'll be able to serve most patients during the COVID crisis. If there are people in the MR or TMBS community struggling without insurance, underinsured, and can't afford copay, need basic medical attention, I'm willing to help out with care at no cost. We'll keep you posted, but it will start. I will also be available for telemedicine care on Amwell starting on Friday. That is amwell.com/CM to get in touch with Dr. Eric. So he'll keep us in touch with that telemedicine, but you can find amwell.com/CM. This is a company I contract for, so I have no discretion in terms of payment on this platform, but we will update you on Dr. Eric's plan to provide telemedicine. Meanwhile, Nick says, I want a shout out for a friend of mine, Max, who put together a Facebook group for Chester County, PA, called COVID Assistance Network Chester County, trying to connect with people who need assistance with local groups and just people who are willing to help during the crisis. That's a Facebook link. We've got it in our description. Hi, Sam. Thanks for sharing this information. Article and face shield link. Face shields I create, another way of creating a face shields, and donation information that is about personal protective equipment from Stony Brook. That's from Andrew. Since workers are getting, somebody put in my Twin Tiers Health, a Texas company looking to dock paychecks for those receiving stimulus. I didn't get the full story on that. Oh, there it is. Yeah, someone wanted to put that in there. And then they were recommending, this is from Spencer, that we do Tequila Tuesdays, maybe. Matt says, for all the parents at home with their kids developing lesson plans, this is important. We're already starting to look on this. For all the parents at home, kids developing lesson plans, check out Pop Culture Classroom. It's popcultureclassroom.org. There are tons of free resources in lesson plans, including how to make comic books and or games, educational history comics, lesson plans to accompany popular age-appropriate graphic novels, et cetera, et cetera. Matt helped create some of these resources. Check that out. That's exciting for me in particular. We have a helpful CPA in Bronx. One of our listeners posted what they told them. It answers what benefits are there for individual taxpayers. They wrote out six different things, so you can check that out. I didn't create this website, says Matt, but I found it useful for tracking real-time coronavirus updates around the U.S. and Canada. That's coronavirus.1.3acres.com. Coronavirus1.3acres.com. Hi, MR crew. I'm offering free tutoring for math and science courses using Zoom to help out students that need help getting through their online courses. Schedule is 3:30 to 5 through Monday through Friday. All you need to do is use this link. It's a Zoom link. We will post it. This is from Michael at michaelfuscotutor.com. michaelfuscotutor.com. And here's a plug from Shashank. Shashank, I guess. The Shashank RK Studio does sheet music and piano tracks for needs like gigs, auditions, and practice. To support fellow artists like me have fallen on hard times, I'm offering commission-free sheet music for single instruments. These are massively discounted. You can go to ShashankRKStudio.com. We will put a link to that as well. Those are our plugs and notices for 331. You can send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Put in the subject line, plugs and notices, and we will do your plugs and notice. Meanwhile, I've been using grove.co. I've been hitting it hard, ladies and gentlemen, as of late. Aside from obviously the desire to get cleaning products right now, hand soaps, dish soaps, laundry material, et cetera, wipes when they're available. Grove.co, the Grove Collaborative, it curates all the highest quality, natural, non-toxic, sustainably sourced items that you need in your household. This is Grove Collaborative. It is the online marketplace, like I say, that delivers all natural home, beauty, and personal care products directly to you. Grove takes the guesswork out of going green because every Grove.co product is guaranteed to be good for you, your family, your home, and the planet. Obviously, Grove.co is the first place I went to get my hand soap because, as you know, I like to I have sensitive skin. I have sensitive smells. I've got three big things of Mrs. Meyer's laundry detergent there, and you know, because I don't want to open a lot of different boxes. They generally get it to you in about 48 hours. Right now, they're going about 4 or 5 days, I think, but they ship it right to you. They have just what you need to jumpstart your spring cleaning routine. They also tend to get some products in. They tend to sell out right now in this instance of things that you need less right now. But check it out. Hand soap, very important these days. And they have all the Mrs. Meyer's stuff. My favorite, I know this is going to sound weird, is the candy apple. I know, that's the one I like. Grove has just what you need, like I say, to jumpstart your spring cleaning routine. And you can join over 2 million households who have trusted Grove Collaborative to make their homes happier and healthier. Plus, shipping is fast and free on your first order. For a limited time, when listeners go to grove.co/majority, you're going to get a free 5-piece cleaning set from Mrs. Meyer's and Grove. Crisp scents like mint or rose, a $30 value. Go to grove.co/majority to get this exclusive spring cleaning offer. Grove.co/majority. No better time than to check out grove.co. They may have stuff there that you've been looking for, can't find anywhere else. And of course, they have all natural products and they are supporting the show at a time where, businesses are hurting. And they cut back on their advertising revenues. So much appreciation from them. And it's a product, obviously, like everything that we advertise here that I use. Do we have time? Yeah, we got time. Folks, this is a little bit of a upfront treat. There's a lot a lot of questions that people have during a crisis like this. Tough to get information that you can count on. The obviously what's going on in New York is a horror show right now. And it's a horror show that is coming across the country. Yesterday, Donald Trump, or maybe it was 2 days ago, said it'll be a win if we, you know, somewhere between 100,000, 200,000 deaths will be a big win. But there is some controversy as to what the real numbers are. So let's check in with the foremost public health experts, Diamond and Silk.
A matter of 2 weeks, over 1,000 people supposedly died from corona, from the coronavirus. In a 2 weeks time period, over 1,000 people, after being tested positive, have died from the coronavirus. But it took 39 days from January all the way up to February the 29th, I believe.
That's for Saturday. the first person to die.
Here's another thing.
Come on.
Here's another thing. My president said on March the 24th, Tuesday, this past week.
Wait, pause
My
it.
President said that he...
Pause it. Did, what? What are they saying that since January, what, that it took... I don't understand. Are they saying that that's suspicious because how did it take so long for people to die with coronavirus in this country if the first person had it in January?
It sped up pretty quickly.
Or are they saying it took too long? Well, all right. Go ahead. Keep playing. Oh, God.
On March the 24th, Tuesday, this past week, my president said that he would love
Come
for
on.
America to be back up and running.
I knew this was going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
I knew after he said this was going to happen. Go ahead.
At the time he said it, there was 25,489 cases with 307 deaths. Instantaneously, you had the media calling President Trump out. He wanted open by Easter. He want this open by Easter. Me and you were talking. I said, now watch the numbers of deaths go up.
Right.
Watch everything increase because they wanted to make it look bad.
That's right.
In front of our eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Here it is 5 days later.
Mm-hmm.
5 days later as of yesterday. It jumped from 25,489 cases up to 121,478 cases. It went from 307 deaths to 2,026 deaths
in five days.
And the media is reporting that now the USA far surpassed. We're number one now with the number of cases.
This is fascinating to watch Diamond and Silk begin to understand the implications of a pandemic and then, of course, say that it's all been made up. And, you know, this is, on one hand, it's sort of hilarious. On another hand, it's sort of just one of the most effing disturbing things in the world. And part of the reason why I want to play this before this interview with Rick Hassan is that Hassan has written this book that contemplates different scenarios where the election could go awry in the fall. Of course, he wrote this before we had a global pandemic. But one of the things that is that makes the election so precarious in the fall is that there is a, I don't know how to put this, that there is a significant segment of the population that is politically engaged, that is bat crap crazy. And also, with all due respect to Diamond and Silk, incredibly stupid. I mean, I genuinely don't know. I mean, I hope, I pray on some level that Diamond and Silk are just running some type of scam because it suggests that maybe one day they could go like, maybe we shouldn't do this anymore. But it also seems to me very possible that they genuinely believe what they're talking about, which is also terrifying. And certainly there are hundreds of thousands of right-wingers who do. We think of that like, that's very suspicious. this highly contagious disease, which has a mortality rate anywhere from 7 to 10 times the flu, is exponentially growing in terms of its taking lives. That's highly suspicious. It must be a media story. And so if they can do this with that, what can they do with the results of an election? Well, I think you can imagine. And we will take a quick break and get in touch with Rick Hassan to find out what we're supposed to do about that. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program author of Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy, also the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. Rick Hassan, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
When you wrote the book, you had contemplated a whole series of things that could go wrong with our election, and there's a new one. But I guess in some respects, the specifics might change under this scenario, and it's not a mutually exclusive thing, I guess. But the dynamic is, it seems to me, is pretty similar. From what you had sort of, I guess, contemplated as a potential problem coming up in November.
Sure. So, you know, what I think is that the coronavirus epidemic is only going to exacerbate the pathologies that I described in the book. What I'm looking at in Election Meltdown is why Americans' confidence in the election process is going down, why it is that people are worried that a good chunk of the country won't accept the 2020 election results as legitimate, regardless of who wins. And I talk about the use of voter suppression tactics by Republicans in a number of states that make it harder to register and vote, as undermining both Republican and Democratic confidence in the process, Republicans believing that Democrats are using voter fraud to steal elections, despite all evidence to the contrary, and Democrats believing that all of these laws are being passed to suppress the vote, pockets of election administrator incompetence, dirty tricks,
right,
like misinformation spread by the Russians, and an increasingly incendiary rhetoric about stolen elections. And you add on top of that the kind of changes and last-minute problems that are inevitably going to arise if we're still in the throes of this pandemic in November. And it really is a recipe for lots of people to not trust that the election is going to be conducted fairly.
All right. So let's start just sort of like, I guess, maybe work backwards and touch on these four elements that you talk about. And I guess also the, you know, the sort of the exogenous issue of you know, what could have been like a terrorist attack. I mean, you know, nothing's off the table at this point. Certainly the coronavirus is, I think, likely to, you know, in some way impact our voting. And I also, I just want to touch on just what's happening in terms of these primaries, but it's a different, we're talking sort of a different domain in some respects. Let's just start. And I know that we've actually talked about this a little bit on this program the past couple of weeks, but let's just work backwards. In terms of a federal election, which is the presidential election as opposed to the primaries, a federal election, what are the, I guess, the legal concepts, the controlling law, the precedent regarding federal elections and moving them and who administers them and who controls them?
Sure. So the Congress is given the power to set the time for the presidential election. And I believe it was an 1845 statute in which Congress set the time as the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, as well as a timetable for the counting of the Electoral College votes. And then the Constitution provides that, you know, if it doesn't happen by basically January 20th, then we go with the order of succession that is put in place by Congress, and the president doesn't get to hold anything over. So, you know, the idea that we would postpone the election, which I hear a lot about, that would be in Congress's domain. But that's not to say that the president couldn't do things like use martial law or call for quarantines or do things that could keep people from going to the polling place. But in terms of actually moving the election date, that is something that would be beyond the president's power in the Constitution. In terms of the rules for conducting the election, when it comes to federal elections, Article 1, Section 4 of the Constitution says that it is up to the states to set the rules for the manner of conducting congressional elections, but that is subject to congressional override. So, for example, in 1993, Congress passed the National Voter Registration Act, also known as the Motor Voter Law. And that law says that regardless of what a state's rules are for registering voters to vote in local and state elections, for congressional elections, you have to provide these other avenues for voting. And that's why, for example, DMVs have to offer voter registration in other public offices, and why there's a postcard that the federal government creates that can be used for voter registration and all of that. So if Congress wanted to, for example, as the Democrats have suggested, require every state to offer no excuse absentee balloting for November, Congress would have the power to do that if it wanted to do so. So that's now, kind of the basic overview of this.
So the by Congress, I mean, they passed that law. The president would have to sign it, though.
Right. The president would have to sign it. Presumably, it would be in one of these coronavirus relief bills. We heard the president yesterday say that Democrats were asking for crazy things, and if one of those things, which was the no excuse absentee balloting, would have been included, no Republican would ever be elected to office again, which of course is untrue. We've had plenty of elections run by mail where Republicans are elected. Right. But the idea is the only way that Democrats could politically get something like this through is if it were part of the package of relief efforts that are being passed by Congress, you know, kind of must pass bills that the president would have to sign. I guess that Pelosi could not get this included in the final bill that was what they're calling phase three, but she was on, I think it was Morning Joe this morning, saying that she still thinks it needs to happen. So maybe they're going to try again for phase four.
Well, I hate to be a cynic, but one, let's put a pin in that because I want to return to sort of that dynamic about the Democrats when it comes to voting. And two, I would say if I had to bet right now that somehow the override to the SALT exclusion that was in the last tax bill, I have a feeling is going to be higher on the priority list than that, which is a shame. But that is neither here nor there in terms of this conversation, but I couldn't help myself. So with that said, and we should also add, right, that governors in specific states have that same ability that Trump does nationally insofar as the election's happening. However, I'm doing a lockdown of this, let's say this, that just so happens to coincide with this congressional district that is heavily African-American, let's say, or, you know, Milwaukee has a stay at home order on election day. Right. I mean, theoretically, I don't know that Evers would do that, but theoretically that could be done.
Sure. Right. So this is a concern in states. It's unlikely to happen given that the election is going to be going on, or there would be an exception to it. But governors have the public health power. And we saw this in Ohio when, you may remember, a few weeks ago, we were supposed to have four primaries: Ohio, Illinois, Florida, and Arizona. And then a couple of days before the Ohio primary was supposed to happen, the governor, DeWine, tried to get a court to order him to delay the election because he didn't think he had the power to do so under the state constitution. The court refused to do that, and then he still thought he had to delay the election, so he had his public health officer close the polling places. At that point, the Secretary of State issued an order delaying the election. There's disagreement as to whether or not that complied with Ohio state law. The legislature later came in and came up with a new set of guidelines for how the election is going to take place, and there's now litigation over those guidelines. But that, of course, is in the primary when the timing is much less important. You're right that something happened in a particular state where people could not get to the polls. It's going to be a real problem. That's why my advice to everyone is, to the extent that there is the ability to vote absentee, it's the kind of thing you should take advantage of. And in about 2/3 of the states, there's no excuse absentee balloting. The problem is getting people to apply for those absentee ballots and getting those ballots to them and getting them returned, which is not an easy thing. Not even to talk about the difficulties of counting a huge number of absentee ballots that might come in.
And I want to get to some of the limitations on voting by mail as well. Although I think, you know, when we get more into like a solution or a fix, particularly in this context, but, and then before we get to the sort of like four different categories, you also make the point in the book that it is our the Electoral College, and I hadn't contemplated this, which I think is not necessarily the most democratic way to elect a president, but it also creates it makes the system more vulnerable to all of the things that you lay out here, because you don't have to change the vote totals in such a massive way because we don't have a popular vote. But in fact, you can do something very targeted. I mean, you could literally turn a federal election based upon one or two counties, theoretically, in the country.
Well, I actually think it's much worse than that. And this has gotten very little attention nationally so far, which is that if you remember back in Bush versus Gore, the Supreme Court case that ended the 2000 election.
I do.
The Supreme Court included a line in its opinion that said the Constitution gives state legislatures the power to choose the manner of picking presidential electors in the state. And although every state has given that power to the voters, a state legislature can come back at any time and take that power back. And so one of the nightmare scenarios I worry about is suppose that there are widespread closures in Philadelphia. A few days before the election, the Republicans in the state legislature decide, you know, we don't think we can conduct a fair election because there are so many closed polling places. We're just going to appoint the electors ourselves, and we appoint them to Trump. I think that would be constitutional. I think there would be rioting in the streets, but I think that would be constitutional. So this is one of the many problems with the Electoral College. It's profoundly undemocratic. It's been made more democratic by political decisions that have been made, but those decisions could be reversed under the Constitution.
And so we have like sort of the both the sort of the structural flaws that make it more vulnerable, and then just sort of the design itself is a bit of a disaster waiting to happen. So, all right, let's talk about the supposed election security methods that that end up in many respects sort of destabilizing the vote in some way.
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, you write that there are four, you know, one of the things that you talk about these election security methods, and it undermines the confidence in the election.
So I was talking mostly about election administrator incompetence. So when it's a very close election, even if 95-98% of the election administrators have done a very good job conducting the election, if it's very close, the attention focuses immediately on the places where there are problems. And there are pockets in the United States, both run by Democrats and run by Republicans, where elections are administered really poorly. One example of this, the city of Detroit, where you may remember Jill Stein in 2016 after the presidential election asked for recounts in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. All of those ended up getting aborted after a while. But when they tried to do the recount in Detroit, there were so many errors in how poll workers tried to count the ballots by putting them through these ballot tabulating machines that they couldn't even conduct the recount in part of Detroit, because state law said that Michigan state law said that if the vote totals don't match, you know, what you've written down and what's in the machine, then, you know, you can't do a recount. And so there was a later investigation by the Michigan Secretary of State's office, which found that there was no intentional foul play, although there were lots of accusations of that on Fox News and elsewhere, but massive incompetence. And so, you know, in terms of voter confidence, you know, what happens if, let's say, it's the election comes down to Michigan and Trump is ahead by 3,000 votes because there are 6,000 absentee ballots that have been rejected in Milwaukee because of purported signature mismatches? You know, are we going to fight over people's signatures? You know, how is all of that going to work? And so I really worry that, in a very close election, the public's confidence can be severely undermined by these places where there is incompetent election administration. And one of the things I called for in a piece that I had in Slate yesterday is that there needs to be more state control over these weak links. States need to assert greater control to make sure that these weak areas of election administration are getting the support they need and getting the leadership they need to actually be able to conduct a fair election in November.
So let me go back to the security, the election security stuff. Like, for instance, voter ID. It is, you write that it's not as disenfranchising as, you know, some of us might believe it is. But this again undermines confidence in the elections, both for Democrats and for Republicans. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So the, voter ID laws are supposedly put in place to prevent voter fraud, but the kind of voter fraud that voter ID laws would prevent is where people would go to the polling place and claim to be someone who's either dead or moved and vote their ballot, and that this would happen on a large enough scale that you could actually try to swing an election. It doesn't happen. We don't have, you know, lots of modern cases of organized efforts to do this because it is a very inefficient a way to try to steal an election. You'd have to send people to the polling places. They'd have to pretend to be other people. And you'd have to hope that the poll workers wouldn't know, oh, that's my name, the name of my neighbor who's moved or who's died. You'd have to pay these people to go in and commit this felony and pay them even though you can't verify how they would have voted. That's why I think if Republicans who suggested these laws were really concerned about fraud, they would focus much more on absentee ballots. Historically, they've not focused on that because Republicans have tended to use absentee ballots more. But now we're seeing with this new Pelosi move to try to expand absentee balloting, a newfound focus on this kind of fraud. Now, in terms of the disenfranchising effects of voter ID, the studies are mixed, but they tend to show that they don't have a very large effect on turnout. This is probably true for a few different reasons. One is that there are lots of countermeasures that are taken when a state comes in and passes one of these laws to try to ensure that the people who want to vote can get the ID. Also, people who lack IDs are people who are probably least likely to vote, you know, the poorest, most unconnected people in society who lack this ID are also people who are not going to show up and vote. And so if you look at that measure in particular, voter ID laws, there does not seem to be a big effect on turnout. That doesn't make them legitimate. In fact, I think focusing on whether it turns elections or affects turnout should really be secondary to the question of why does the state get to make it harder for people to register and vote without providing a real good reason? And the state generally provides the reasons of preventing voter fraud or promoting voter confidence. And we know that these laws don't actually do that. But there are other kinds of laws, and I write in Election Meltdown about a Kansas law that required people to provide documentary proof of citizenship, like a birth certificate or a naturalization certificate, in order to be able to register and vote. We know that law in Kansas had disenfranchised 30,000 people before a federal court had come in and put a stay, an injunction in place to prevent that law from being enacted, or to prevent that law from being enforced, I should say. And so when you think about the variety of laws that might suppress the vote, lots of focus on voter ID laws, but I actually think there are many other laws, exact match laws, voter purges, things that probably have a larger effect than voter ID in particular.
And I imagine too, though, I mean, that the efforts that are put into dealing with the voter ID, right? The people come in, groups come in, and they get people these IDs. They spend a lot of manpower and money that theoretically could be deployed in driving out the vote in other areas. I mean, theoretically. But all this is the fact that the state can abridge this right to vote is a function of, I guess, the failure of the 15th Amendment, right? To sort of to be an affirmative, to rather than constrain the states specifically how they can abridge the vote, as opposed to just saying there is a constitutional right to vote.
Yeah, right. I think that's right. And I also think that lots of these laws, like voter ID laws, end up deterring people from voting because they create a lot of confusion. And so, you know, you see even in states where voter ID laws have been put on hold or where they've been loosened, poll workers don't always get the message, or voters. There's a lot of survey evidence that voters misunderstand voter ID laws. Lots of voters who actually have an ID that would qualify don't think they do, and that could deter them from voting. Or you can think about this ongoing controversy in Florida over Florida's felon disenfranchisement law. Voters in Florida a few years ago passed an amendment to the state constitution that re-enfranchised former felons from voting. The state legislature came back and said, well, you can only vote unless you can't vote if you're a former felon unless you've paid all your fines and fees. And there's no repository in the state. So you can't, if you're a former felon, you can't just check a database and find out if you owe any money. You might owe $15 in court costs somewhere from something 20 years ago. And you'd have to sign a piece of paper under penalty of perjury that you have no fines or fees against you related to your convictions. There's now a bunch of lawsuits, and those requirements could well be put on hold for November. But all of these laws that make it harder to register and vote, all of these impediments that are put up create lots of confusion among voters and poll workers, and that itself has a deterrent effect on who turns out to vote.
Let's talk about general dirty tricks. I mean, what constitutes dirty tricks, and are we in an era where those tricks have gotten dirtier?
Well, there have been dirty tricks associated with American elections for as long as we've had elections. You know, we've had tires slashed and phone lines jammed and all kinds of things in the past that try to make it harder for people to get people to the polls or to you know, get out the vote, or misdirecting people to the wrong polling place and things like that. Back in 2012, I had a book called The Voting Wars, and I have a picture in there of a flyer that was distributed at dorms at the University of Wisconsin telling people to vote at the polling place of their choice. when in fact, if you would have gone to any polling place but the one you were assigned, your vote wouldn't count. But now we have kind of newfangled dirty tricks in the form of social media misinformation. We saw the Russians doing it in 2016, but you don't need the Russians to do it anymore. There are plenty of Americans who are willing to engage in spreading misinformation. And I think, you know, certainly during the time of the coronavirus, it's possible to spread misinformation related to the virus that could keep people from the polls. Telling people don't go to the polling place because, you know, you can get infected from the machines or polling places are closed or moved or all kinds of things. I think we really have to be on the lookout for that kind of false information. And spreading it over social media means that you can have a lot more of an impact than you would, and you could do this from anywhere in the world, unlike the situation I described with those flyers that someone had to walk over to the dorms at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and distribute these flyers, and maybe they got into people's hands, maybe they didn't. It's possible for social media, for relatively little effort, to reach thousands and thousands of people. So I am concerned, especially about the use of social media to spread misinformation related to the election coming up.
And you also talk about a scenario, and I don't know if this falls into dirty tricks, but a foreign power hacking into our power grid, and because of the nature of our elections, you know, making it impossible to vote in Detroit, let's say, and then what do we do?
Right. So this was one of my top nightmare scenarios pre-coronavirus in the book Election Meltdown. And one of the things that I urge at the end of that book is that more states need to have a plan B in case there is a disruption of the election. And, you know, that is still true today, even though states are now on notice that there could be disruptions of the election, you know, whether it's natural disaster or some kind of foreign attack. Many states have not done anything to provide, you know, here, what would happen if people could not get to polling places in Detroit on election day? What's the procedure going to be? How is this going to be dealt with? And these things, I've been arguing this for over 20 years, these kinds of last minute emergencies really create a legitimacy problem for elections, because if you have to make decisions at the time of the actual emergency, you're much more likely to know who the winner and loser of your decision might be. Much better in advance, behind the veil of ignorance, to set fair election rules that would apply in the event of an emergency. And yet, states are doing almost nothing. I was amazed that I think it was 2 weeks ago, the Kentucky legislature decided to continue meeting despite the coronavirus orders, you know, across the country for people to stay at home and not gather in large groups. They decided to get together and still pass legislation, and they passed a strict voter identification law, but they did not take any action to try to deal with the kind of emergencies that could disenfranchise people and create problems with how the election is run. And,
well,
and now we're really paying the price.
But why? I mean, you've been doing that. Why has there been, you know, after 2000 in particular, like, why has there been such an absence of addressing this either on a federal level or, I mean, it's been shocking to witness this, that we, what we went through in 2000 and to, you know, like, over the course of whatever it was, 16 years, we couldn't come up with a better way of like, you know, codifying this stuff. Why is it that there is, seems to be this sort of allergy towards dealing with this issue?
Well, you know, it's baffling to me. You know, there, it's the same reason we don't have, you know, plans for remote voting right now in Congress. You know, I just, it is, political leaders are not willing to deal with these issues sometimes until it is too late. And this is not a Republican Democratic issue, right? So Nancy Pelosi is not allowing remote voting in the House. Not even doesn't want to have a conversation about it, even though I think there are reports this morning of two more House members that are presumably positive for the virus. So it's really a problem. I remember back, some of your listeners may remember in 2003, we had a recall in California. We recalled Governor Gray Davis, replaced him with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And in that election, The reason there were 135 candidates on the ballot was because there was a kind of a glitch in how the recall rules were written. They were internally contradictory, and the state Secretary of State of California read it one way, which basically said if you got 65 signatures and $3,000, you could get on the ballot. And California still hasn't fixed that, right? So even after problems happen, it's very hard to get legislators to be focused on emergency plans, maybe in part because they would rather wait and see what might benefit them as right. It might get closer to an emergency. But it really is baffling to me.
It's nuts. And then you also cite incendiary rhetoric, which is basically, and I think we can talk about 2016 in this context, but I imagine it, you know, on some level, it goes both ways at this point. Donald Trump saying, you know, the election's rigged, or anybody, you know, saying the election is rigged and therefore the outcome is not correct, and how people will take that. I was fascinated by the, and I hadn't heard this about the Obama contingency plan. If Clinton had won and Trump did not accept the results, will you talk about that? Because this, I think it's illustrative of a problem that the Democrats have, but explain what that was.
Well, first, the reason we care about this rhetoric is that this should be too obvious to even have to say, but a democracy depends upon the losers of the election accepting the election results as legitimate, believing that the vote totals were correct, and, you know, being upset about losing, but saying, all right, well, it was a fair fight. I'm going to fight another day. Hopefully we'll win the next time. If you lose that, you lose your very democracy if people believe that election results are being rigged or stolen. And in 2016, the Obama administration was concerned enough that Trump would not accept a result. He even said he would only accept the results, or he would accept the results if he won the election, kind of joking, always half joking about these kinds of things. And so the Obama administration was prepared to trot out people like Colin Powell to say, no, you know, the election was done fair and square, and, you know, people need to accept the results and move on. And it almost seems quaint now to think that the base of the Republican Party would accept Colin Powell over the word of Donald Trump as a, you know, as the voice of reason. But I also think it is not just Donald Trump who's the problem. And so I think that I'm very concerned with the language surrounding the loss that Stacey Abrams had in running for governor against Brian Kemp in 2018. Brian Kemp, remember, was the Secretary of State running for governor. So he was running and running in his election. He did some terrible things, and I described those terrible things in Election Meltdown. But there was no good evidence that what he did actually swung the election against Abrams, and she would have won otherwise. And yet you had Senator Sherrod Brown saying the election was stolen. And I think that kind of rhetoric is really dangerous. It should be reserved for situations where you can actually prove that that an election would have come out a different way. And, you know, certainly fine to call Kemp a vote suppressor, certainly fine to point out that he was both incompetent and evil in how he ran his election. I think he did some terrible things. But when you start talking about stolen elections, and you start talking about elections being rigged, I think you undermine the very democracy that we need to preserve right now, especially in these kinds of times.
But I mean, how do we deal with this, right? I mean, because, you know, the idea of we're going to bring out Colin Powell. And I mean, that to me just seems like such an anemic response to what would have been a massive problem. Like, everybody loves Colin Powell. Maybe we can get, you know, I don't know, you know, some other celebrity to come out and say, everybody just calm down and accept the results here. You know, and I feel like that impulse was also driving Al Gore in some respects to sort of stand down in Florida in 2000. And what one of the things that I think going into the impeachment of Donald Trump struck me was that this plan was not, it seems to me, and maybe you have, I'm curious as to your perspective on it, the idea of going and digging up Burisma and this and that was only sort of part of the plan. The other part of the plan, assuming that they had never been caught like they were, was to make it as if Ukraine was interfering with our elections and set up almost an insurance policy that, you tell me if you think this is wild conjecture, that Bill Barr could say on November, whatever it is, 4th or 5th, the day after the election, like, we have evidence that Ukrainians interfered in this election. That's why Joe Biden won. And therefore, I'm going to the Supreme Court to contest this election. I mean, how batty is that scenario?
Well, I don't know that, you know, Bill Barr saying that would be the thing. I mean, I think it would be Trump claiming victory when he's lost is what I'm worried about. A much more plausible scenario is that there's a flood of absentee ballots, you know, whether coronavirus is raging or not. There's a flood of absentee ballots in Michigan and Pennsylvania, which now both for the first time allow no excuse absentee balloting. And Trump's ahead on election night, and he claims that the votes are being fraudulently counted in Philadelphia and in Detroit, and that's what ends up eventually giving him the victory. And then there's a fight in Congress over whose electoral college votes get to count. I mean, I think that's a much more plausible way that this happens than you know, trying to blame foreign sources for interfering in the election. Unless Bill Barr would have evidence that vote totals will have changed. One of the advantages of our hyper decentralized system is that which I don't favor the hyper decentralized system, but one advantage is that there's decentralized vote counts. You'd really have to point to problems in particular states that would have done it. If it's the Ukrainian spread misinformation, well, we already had something like that in 2016, and that didn't change election results. So there's lots of nightmare scenarios, lots of ways in which there could be claims that the election was not fairly conducted and not counted, and people shouldn't accept election results. But they wouldn't necessarily require foreign interference as a hook to try and do that.
Right. So how do we inoculate ourselves against, do we inoculate ourselves against specific ones like the one you're talking about? Or are there inoculations that we can get in terms of like the broad problem?
Well, I think the problems, the places where voter confidence could be undermined, cut across different areas. There's a role for the media to play. There's a role for state election administrators to play. There's a role for, you know, the general public to play in terms of demanding that transparency from election administrators. I'm actually part of an ad hoc group that I hope in about a month will be releasing about 20 specific things that could be done to try to deal with this problem and to minimize the chances that we would have this kind of election overtime fight over who actually won the election in 2020, because it would be much more brutal than what we saw in the 2000 election between Bush and Gore.
Let's play out your scenario. Trump says, I'm the winner. This whole thing is very suspicious that they found new votes in Detroit or something, or they found new votes in Milwaukee, or they found new votes in Philadelphia. That's very suspicious. I'm the president. Like, then what happens?
Well, I think then, you know, at least legally, what would happen is the re-election results would be reported. There would be a certificate saying who won the electoral college votes. In a really bad scenario, there could be more than one certificate. It would go to Congress, and there would be a fight in Congress as to how the electoral college votes should be counted and who would be declared the president. There's a whole set of convoluted rules that Congress created after the disputed 1876 election that would come into play. Some of those rules could be challenged as unconstitutional. We could well see the issue go back before the Supreme Court, or there's lots of ways that it could play out in that would either be decided by political branches or by courts as to who the winner of the election would be. It's one of those things that is really hard to game out because there's lots of different ways that it could go.
Is the broadly speaking, the legal institutions, you're on a task force to deal with, is this a task force that is like contemplating this type of question? Are there lawyers, you know, gathering in conference rooms saying, hey, in the event that this happens, we need to do X, Y, or Z?
Right. So we're trying to do that. But, you know, a lot of these things are pointing out what the problems are. And, you know, the only one that could fix these some of these problems with the way the Electoral College votes work is Congress. And I don't see Congress tackling them anytime before November. You know, there's a limit to what can be done in time for November. It's not as though we in the election law community haven't been pointing out these problems for years. You know, as we talked about earlier, this has been an ongoing problem. And, you know, our leaders have their heads in the sands and they are not looking at, you know, what it would take to ensure that we have fair and clear procedures in place to deal with disputes like this.
Rick Hasen, thank you so much for giving us something different to worry about.
Yeah, well, it's always good to have variety, I guess.
Exactly. The book is Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye. Well, there you go, folks. It's like the strategy of, you know, my ankle hurts. Oh, okay. Well, let me hit your finger with a hammer. And so now you're not thinking about your ankle. This is what next, right? All right. We are going to take a quick break and head to the fun half. And Nomiki Konst is going to be joining me in the fun half. Live from Arizona, which reminds me, you can check out the Noma Key Show at patreon.com/the Noma Key Show. And also, Noma Key Konst on YouTube, youtube.com/Noma Key Konst. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. When you become a member, you keep this show cruising along. You know, it's tough time that we're all headed into. If you do not have the financial resources to become a member and want access to the full show, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Give us a little time. We will get to it. And if you're one of those people who can afford to support the show at this time, this would be a great time to do it. We're, we've got members who are losing their jobs. We've got advertisers that are cutting back. Any support you can give us at this time, greatly appreciated. Also, don't forget, check out justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. And the AM Quickie is now on YouTube. I posted to YouTube, and there's like a little graphic. Bull Prog did the animation for that, right, Brendan? Got the Bullprog did the like a image of myself and Lucy, and you can check that out on YouTube, or you can just sign up for it at amquickie.com. That's a great way to do it as well. Don't forget TMBS tonight. You can see that at youtube.com, the Michael Brooks Show, patreon.com/TMBS. Also, Jamie's been putting out new antifadas. You can find that at patreon.com/The Antifada. And Matt, what's up with Literary Hangover?
Literary Hangover is recording again tomorrow night, and that will be out on Saturday. The Widow Ranter by Afro Ben, we're going to be talking about gender and Bacon's Rebellion. So look forward to that. Also, I was on the Surf's Twitch channel last night. People said people were really loving it, just going crazy over there. So you can check that out as well.
All right. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Try and get to some calls. We may not, and but we'll see. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.